Chapter 32. Nabil Lababidi glanced at the nuclear bomb sitting on the wood floor of the apartment, just off the strand, with excitement tempered by apprehension. It was an inert object, mainly machined metal and a few copper wires, but it emitted a feeling of awe and danger. The bomb was more than just an object. It had a life. Like a painting or a sculpture infused with the life force of its creator, the bomb was not simply a hunk of metal. It was the answer to his people's prayers. They would strike directly at the heart of the British. The hated British that had stolen artifacts from the pyramids, oppressed the citizens of the Middle East, and fought alongside the Americans in battles they had no place mounting. Lababidi was smack dab in the center of the lion's den. Downtown London was all around him. The city, where the bankers that funded the oppression resided, the art galleries, museums, and theater districts of downtown were nearby. Number 10 Downing Street, the Houses of Parliament, Buckingham Palace. The palace, home to the Queen, the ancient symbol of all he despised, the pomp and circumstance, the righteousness and ceremony. Soon it would all burn with the fires from the sword of Islam, and when it was over, the world would never be the same. A heart would be cut from the beast. The hallowed ground, seeping with history, would become a barren wasteland where the human soul would find no purchase. Lababidi lit a cigarette. It wouldn't be long now. Sometime today, the young Yemeni warrior who had agreed to deliver the payload to the target would arrive in the city. Lababidi would wine and dine the boy, supply whores and hashish and tasty treats. He could do no less for a man willing to commit to the cause with his life. Once the boy was acclimated and knew the route, Lababidi would make a hasty retreat. The key to leadership, he thought, was not to die for your country. It was to make the other man die for his. And Nabil Lababidi had no designs on becoming a martyr himself. By the time the bomb exploded, he'd be safely across the English Channel in Paris. He only wondered why he had not heard from Al-Khalifa.
"I don't know how we missed it," Rogers said.
"No matter," Meadows said. "Now you have a plate number on the truck. Track it down, and the bomb will be close."
"Could I have the tape?" Rogers asked.
Meadows didn't disclose that he'd had the author make two copies, and that one of them was safely inside the borrowed Range Rover.
"Sure," he said. "I think we can take it from here," Rogers said, reasserting his authority. "I'll make sure and have my boss notify the head of the American intelligence to praise you for your contribution."
The constant struggle between people and agencies was exerting itself. Rogers must have been briefed by his superiors that whatever might happen, MI5 needed to receive credit for recovering the bomb. Now that he had what he believed would allow them to recover the bomb, he was trying to push the corporation into the background.
"I understand," Seng said. "Do you mind if we keep the rover for a few more days?"
"No, please, help yourself," Rogers said.
"And would it be all right if we questioned the owner of the pub?" Meadows asked. "Just so we can complete our file and all."
"We've already extensively grilled the man," Rogers said, considering the request for a long moment. "So I can't see how it can hurt."
Rogers reached for his cell phone to call in the van's plate number, then stared at the two Americans with expectation.
"Thank you,"
Seng said, motioning to Meadows to walk toward the Range Rover, leaving Rogers alone. Rogers gave a semi-salute and dialed the phone. Meadows opened the door and climbed behind the wheel as Seng slid into the passenger seat.
"Why'd you give him the tape?" Seng said when the doors were closed.
Meadows pointed to the copy on the floor, then started the Range Rover and spun it around in a U-turn.
"Let's go visit the pub owner," he said, "and see what else we can find out."
"Are you thinking what I'm thinking?"
Seng asked a few minutes later as Meadows stopped in front of the bar.
"I don't know," Meadows said. Does it have to do with the motorcycle that was also on the tape?
Why don't I call it in, Seng said, while you go inside?
Meadows climbed out of the Range Rover.
You got a damn good memory, he said.
Seng held up his palm where the number was scrawled in ink.
Meadows closed the door and walked to the pub entrance.
The trees in St. James and Green Parks near Buckingham Palace were devoid of leaves, and the dormant grass was dusted with a thick frost. Tourists watched the changing of the guards with puffs of steam coming from their mouths. A man on a scooter came down Piccadilly, then turned onto Grosvenor Place, and drove slowly past the lake inside Buckingham Palace Gardens. Continuing on, he rounded the corner onto Buckingham Palace Road to where it met the Birdcage Walk. Pulling to the side of the road alongside the lake inside St. James Park, he recorded his travel times and the traffic conditions. Then he slid the small notebook back into his jacket pocket and puttered away. Cabrillo poked his head out of the side window of the MG. An hour ago, when he had driven past Ben Nevis, the tallest mountain in Scotland, he'd been gaining on the van. Now, as the MG labored up the Grampian Mountains, the van was pulling ahead once again. Something needed to happen, soon. Cabrillo expected to see Adams in the Robinson, the British Army or Air Force or even a police car, any minute. He was sure the Oregon was sending help. He was unarmed in an underpowered chase car. Surely someone had figured out where he was by now. On board the Oregon, they were working on the problem with limited success. The ship was still 100 miles from Kinnaird's Head, steaming south at full speed. In a few more hours, she'd be off Aberdeen. A few more, and she'd cross a point offshore Edinburgh.
"Okay," Cassim shouted across the control room to Hanley. "Adams reports he has enough fuel loaded on board to make it to the airport in Inverness. Once there, he'll top off the tanks and head south along the road."
"How much range will he have then?" Hanley asked.
"Hold on,"
Cassim said, repeating the question to Adams.
"Most of England," Cassim said, "but he won't be able to make London without refueling."
"We should have this wrapped up before then," Hanley said.
"Okay,"
Cassim shouted.
"Adams said he has the engine going."
"Tell him to follow the road until he finds Cabrillo,"
Cassim repeated the orders.
"He said the fog is as thick as a winter coat," Cassim said. "But he'll fly right above the road."
"Good,"
Hanley said. Linda Ross walked over to Hanley's chair.
"Boss," she said, "Stone and I reworked the tracking frequencies on the bugs on the meteorite. We're getting a more complete signal now."
"Which monitor?"
Ross pointed to one on the far wall. The meteorite was almost to Stirling. Soon the driver of the van would need to signal his intentions with a turn, east toward Glasgow or west toward Edinburgh.
"Get me Overholt," he said to Stone.
A few seconds later, Overholt came on the line.
"I'll have the British seal off the roads just outside Glasgow and Edinburgh,"
Overholt said,
"and search every truck."
"We're blessed there's not that many roads they can pick from," Hanley said. "They should be able to snag the truck."
"Let's hope,"
Overholt said.
"Now, on another note, I got a call from the head of MI5 thanking Meadows and Seng for the work they are doing on the nuclear bomb problem. Apparently, Meadows located a videotape that gave them a license plate number they think will lead them to the bomb."
"I'm glad," Hanley said.
Overholt paused before speaking again.
"Officially, they also asked if your people could back off now. They want to handle it from here."
"I'll let Meadows and Seng know when they phone in," Hanley told him.
"Well, Max,"
Overholt said,
"if I were you, I wouldn't be in a rush to take their call."
"I get your drift, Mr. Overholt," Hanley said as he hung up.
"Overholt says the British want Meadows and Seng to back off and let them handle the stray nuke,"
Hanley said to Stone.
"You should have told me," Stone said. They just telephoned in to have me run a British motorcycle plate.
Did you locate the owner?
Name and address, Stone said.
What else did they need?
I faxed several dossiers to Meadows' laptop. The landline he used was a number listed in the directory as Pub and Grub on the Isle of Sheppey.
Meadows had learned long ago that threats only worked when someone had something to lose. The agents from MI5 and the local police had made it clear to the owner of the pub what might happen if he did not cooperate. They forgot to mention what might happen if he did. It's easy to gather bees with honey. For information, money works better.
Gold watch, huh?
Meadows was saying as Tseng walked inside and nodded.
Piaget custom, the owner said.
Meadows slid $500 bills across the bar as Tseng walked over and sat down at the bar.
What do you want to drink? Meadows asked Tseng.
Black and tan,
Tseng said without hesitation. The owner went off to draw the drink. Meadows bent down and whispered to Tseng.
How much cash do you have?
10,
Tseng said, meaning 1,000. Meadows nodded and slid the laptop around so both he and the owner could see the screen.
Now, for 5,000 American and our heartfelt thanks, I'm going to scroll through some pictures. If you recognize the man that was with the ship captain, you tell me and I'll stop.
The owner nodded, and Meadows began going through the photographs of Al-Khalifa's known accomplices. They had scrolled through over a dozen before the owner shouted to stop. The pub owner stared at the digital photograph intently.
I think that's him, he said at last.
Meadows turned the laptop back around so the owner couldn't see. Then he unlocked the file showing the pictured man's personal habits.
Did he smoke? Meadows asked.
The owner thought back for a second.
Yes, he did.
Remember the brand? Meadows asked, showing Tseng the information, as if they were engaged in a board game and not a life-and-death situation.
Oh, hell,
the owner said, thinking back. Meadows pointed to the line that mentioned La Babiti had a gold Piaget watch.
I got it, the owner shouted. Marlins! And he had a fancy silver lighter.
Meadows folded the laptop closed and stood up. Pay the man, he said to Tseng. Tseng reached into his jacket pocket and removed a wad of bills, then broke the paper seal. Counting out 50, he handed them to the owner.
Bob, Tseng shouted to Meadows, who was almost at the door, verify for me.
You gave him 5, Meadows said. Duly noted.